So, hey, everybody, welcome back to the Cochise County Travels Podcast. And today we have a returning champion. Actually, we have a returning guest. And we have Mike Bell on the phone today. Now, if you want to learn more about Mike, his very first podcast was January 14th, 2023. So go back into the archives and listen to that one. That's his story. It talks about how he got into Western history and the research and the styles and the things that he did. And then we did another one in 2023. The second podcast was August 8th, 2023. And that's another podcast. We broke down some of the books and we talked about a specific book. So those two podcasts are in the archives. But if you want to know who Mike Bell is, and you're like, who's Mike Bell? Remember to go back to the very first one, which was January 14th, 2023. Before we do that, I want to thank my friends at the Tombstone Epitaph, actually our mutual friends at the Tombstone Epitaph at tombstoneepitaph.com. And if you love a newspaper format and you like to be able to read it and hold it, take it to the airport, you know, maybe lay in bed when you're reading it on a Sunday morning, the newspaper, which is what I love, then go to tombstoneepitaph.com. I also want to thank our mutual friends and second family at the Wild West History Association at wildwesthistory.org and our new digital membership. We have a new digital membership at $60. So if you live a long ways away from the States and Australia, the UK, or wherever shipping is difficult, and you want the journal in a digital format, you can put on your Mac or your laptop and read it at any time in a digital format, then go to the wildwesthistoryassociation.org and become a member with their digital membership at $60. That's a great, great deal, and you get the journal delivered right to your inbox. Also want to thank a new friend. You heard them a week or so back, and that is the BTK Coalition. Josh is doing a great job to bringing Western history and Billy the Kid history and all sorts of really cool stuff through the BTK Coalition. And go to BTKCoalition.com. I want to make sure that I said that right. I got to find my notes. Yep, BTKCoalition.com. So give them a look, and I think you guys will love what you see. So Mike again came to us, and then we did a podcast together. Now, Mike holds a very amazing. He's very distinguished, and he holds something that no other podcaster in my nearly 100 podcasts that we've done so far. He holds the record for the longest single answer to one question by speaking for almost 55 minutes straight. Now, John Bosnecker tried to beat him a couple of years back, but didn't make it. And so Mike holds that record, which is fine because he's a great guest and I love having him on. Now, if you hear any pops or crackles or anything on the phone line, we are using Yahoo Messenger, and he's way over in the UK, and I'm over here in Arizona. So hopefully this digital feed will work out great. And welcome, sir. How are you?
I'm very good. Thank you, Mike. I'm on fine form.
Okay. Well, you should be. We spoke a little while ago, and you're out to dinner with family, so you should be fat and sassy. You should be full and just ready to relax and talk a bunch about the book. The book that we're going to talk about today is The Day the Train Robbers Came, the June 1904 Parachute Train Robbery. And Mike sent that book to me, and we're going to talk about it. So you're doing well. Do you have any new books coming out?
Say again, do I have a new book out?
Yeah, do you have anything in the works or anything coming out?
Well, I've just had one come out called Let Not the Guilty Escape. Ooh. And I think one of our interviews, we talked about the Union Pacific bandit hunters who appear in the famous Butch Cassidy movie for those of us over a certain age. Mm-hmm. And they pursue Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid to the ends of the earth. So they're a major part of the movie. The movie, of course, is 95% fiction. But I was always fascinated by those guys. So I did a piece about 4 years ago called Who Are Those Guys? Which is the question that Paul Newman, alias Butch Cassidy, brings as that in pursued. He keeps saying, who are those guys? Right. And I did a little piece for the English Westerners on the Bandit Hunters about 4 or 5 years ago. But then I uncovered a ton of new information about them. So the book, which is now called Let Not the Guilty Escape, which was the motto of the Union Pacific Special Service, came out a couple of months ago. Okay. So it talks a whole lot about the backstory of the various attacks on the Union Pacific that led them to ultimately form the Bandit Hunters, because every time they thought they'd got it cracked in terms of defending the railroad, somebody else would have another go.
Excellent. Well, today we're talking about, again, the book.
Yep.
Called The Day the Train Robbers Came. He sent it to me. I read it. In fact, I read it really fast. It was really good. You can find it on Amazon. It sells for about $20. It's approximately 249 pages. It was published in 2020 by the English Westerner Society. So if you want this book, it's very easy to go on Amazon and go Mike Bell Parachute Train Robbery. And it will bring it, because there's multiple Mike Bells on Amazon selling books. So you put
really?
In things. What's that?
Really? More
yeah.
than one?
Yeah, there's another one. There's a guy named Michael Bell that sells books. So you got to kind of watch. But if you put in the words Mike Bell, parachute, train robbery in the search queue for Amazon, it'll bring up your book and it'll be easy to find. Again, about 249 pages. It was published in 2020 by the English Westerner Society. Now, the book, we were talking about the storyline, which is about the parachute train robbery. And that is in Parachute, Colorado. And I told you in the pre-interview, right before we spoke, that the book to me was confusing. Because it wasn't the confusing in the read, it's because of the amount of details. Now, the book is packed with photos and illustrations and maps, and it explains how Mike wrote the book, which was he laid out the robbery, the parachute train robbery, and because of the witnesses and the people involved, it's almost like a crime book, or a sleuth, like a mystery. And it's your job to figure out through reading the book who actually the train robbers are. You said that was pretty much correct. That's how you
did it. Yeah, that's entirely right. Because, well, I suppose there are two components to it. One is that even to this day, who took part in the parachute train robbery and who died, one of the train robbers died in the aftermath of the train robbery. And I'm 80% certain that was Harvey Logan, Kid Curry, but you can get a debate about that. So I wanted to explore some of the other potential participants in that. But years and years ago, this interview should be, sadly he's no longer with us, but with a guy called Jim Miller from Colbran, Colorado, who he was kind enough, I don't know, 25 years ago, if not more now, we met because we were both on the board of what was then called the Western Outlaw Lawman Association, which merged with the National Outlaw Law Association to become what is now the Western History, Wild West History Association. And Jim was born and raised in Parachute. He was born in the 40s. He was a kid in school in the 50s. So this was triggered partly by me getting interested in the train robbery by reading books on the outlaws, you know, way back when, which we've talked about in the past. But also because when I met Jim Miller, he told stories about how when he was a kid in school in Parachute, this would be about 1954, 55, I guess he was a 10-year-old, maybe, if that. And one of the parents, his teacher was a guy called Albert Gardner, who was quite a young, new teacher. Albert's dad came into the school with a rifle. And Albert's dad, a guy called Roland Gardner, told the story about how in the aftermath of the train robbery on the 7th of June 1904, the local ranchers had got together to form a posse to go after the train robbers. And to jump to the end of the story, on the 9th of June 1904, there'd been various confrontations between ranchers and train robbers, and various sheriff's posses had come and gone. And right at the end, the train robbers had lost their horses. They'd scaled a scree to get onto some flats above Gibson's Gulch in Colorado. They were coming down the flats, which were dropping away, going back towards the Grand River, the Colorado River. And a handful of the ranchers who knew the territory had got round in front of them, Gulch, and Roller Gardner, Elmer Chapman, Joe Doby, and a few others, just local farm guys. All they wanted to do was, you know, raise their families, raise hay, raise cattle. They didn't want to fight train robbers, but these guys got round between the train robbers and the river. And Roller Gardner told this this school class how as they were coming out of the trees, the brush on the lip of Gibson's Gulch, they saw the train robbers coming down across the flats, because the flats dropped away ever so slightly, coming through the brush and the rocks there. And Elmer Chapman was out front on his horse, and one of the train robbers put a bullet into the horse. The horse went down. Elmer rolled clear and came up onto his knees. And for a split second, it must have been like the world stood still, because Roley Gardner saw this train robber swinging his rifle round, drawing a bead on Elmer. And at that point, Roller just squeezed and fired, and his bullet smashed into the left arm of the train robber, tore across his chest, broke his right arm, went out the other side, and the train robber dropped back out of sight behind a rock. So in that split second, Roley Gardner saved the life of Elmer Chapman. And they all, you know, there's gunfire going on, because there were two other train robbers there with pistols and rifles. Nobody else is hit in this exchange. The farmers, the ranchers fall back into the gully, wondering what's going on. They've got no idea whether this train robber has been hit or whether he's still alive. Elmer's been creased across his cheek. He'd literally, his life was within a hair's breadth of being lost. Then they hear a voice saying, one of the other train robbers crying out to the guy who's gone down, saying, "Tom, are you okay?" or words to that effect. And Tom says, "No, I'm not okay. I'm all done in. I'm going to end it here." Then they hear a single gunshot. And nobody at the time is either stupid enough or brave enough to wander forward across this open ground towards the little knot of rocks where the train robber's gone down. So they wait a while. And they're vaguely aware that the other two train getting the way around behind them. If you're where the ranchers are, they're looking south across the flats to where the train robber's gone down. The other two train robbers are moving east and then around the back, heading back towards the Grand River, and they disappear. And there's all sorts of speculation about who those guys are. But eventually, they realize that this train robber's either dead or dying. So they move forward and they find him lying behind a rock. He's put a pistol bullet through his head. He was Chapman's bullet had done such damage to him that they were actually quite surprised he could even lift a pistol, because it had broken at least one arm, done huge damage to this guy's chest. And that really is where the story either ends or begins, because what fascinated me was, first of all, when I got interested in this train robbery, I remember thinking, well, never in my lifetime will I ever be able to get to see where this took place. When I met Jim Miller, and he was saying, I went there many, many times as a boy, because Roller Gardner, when he finished telling us the story about how he'd brought down the train robber, then, not on the same day, but he took a small party of school kids up Gibson's Gulch to the flats, and he showed them where, 50 years earlier, he'd fought it out with a train robber. So we know exactly from Jim Miller's recollections, and because Albert Gardner, the school teacher, left a manuscript of Rolla's recollections, we know exactly where the fight took place. We know exactly where the train robber went down. In fact, I should have said he was running from one rock to another. He at Elma, which brought down his horse. And then he tried to run from one granite rock to another granite rock. And it was as he was running, he saw Elma get to his knees and stop to take this, what he was going to be a second shot. And that's when Rolla brought him down. So we know exactly where that fight took place. It's now not completely covered up by a shale oil site, but there's a shale oil site that's gone in there now that's right on the edge of the rocks where the fight took place. So I was always fascinated by who was the train robber. Everybody said it was Harvey Logan, but there were other candidates. And then as I was digging into that, it's a bit like the conversation you and I had about Butch Cassidy possibly meeting Owen Wister. I began digging into the lives of these people. And a year after the train robbery, Theodore Roosevelt is president. But Roosevelt likes to take his vacations, you know, in the West. That's great. He's a fascinating character. What he would do was he would head west. He'd set up a temporary White House somewhere in the West while he went off hunting. So in the summer of 1905, Roosevelt goes on a big tour through the West. He goes to Glenwood Springs with his staff. They set up a White House there. Roosevelt, this is, you know, this is the Taylor Swift of the Old West. He's being pursued by paparazzi wherever he goes. So he says to the guys, that the press guys, okay, I'm going to go down Divide Creek on this hunting expedition. You can follow me as far as Newcastle, which is a station a bit further west from Grand Junction. You can take all the photographs you like. I'll make a speech in the back of the train. I'm going on down to Texas for a rendezvous with former Rough Riders. I'm going to Oklahoma to meet a guy called Wolf, a wolf catcher called Jack Abernathy. I can't even say it. But once I head south down Divide Creek, you're not to follow me. And Roosevelt made it quite clear in pithy terms that any reporter found following him would be, how shall we say, escorted from the premises, because Roosevelt wanted his 3 weeks hunting. And long story short, the hunting trip was a bit of a disaster. The weather was foul, absolutely foul. It rained solidly for most of the time. They, you know, they caught a few bear and whatever. But the link between the Roosevelt visit and the train robbery is that Elmer Chapman, the guy who'd been saved by Rolly Gardner, was appointed as Roosevelt's courier during the 3 weeks that Roosevelt was supposedly on this hunting tour. And Chapman's job was on a daily basis to ride from whichever camp Roosevelt was in, and they camped in three or four places on the upper reaches of Divide Creek. His job was to ride back to where Divide Creek empties into what was then the Grand River, now the Colorado, at a little tiny town called Silt, and hand over correspondence. So any incoming, you know, messages that Roosevelt had to deal with would be waiting for him there, and vice versa. So in the book, it suddenly struck me that it was impossible that Roosevelt, being the character he was, with a fascination for all things to do with the West, first of all, he knew about the train robbery. There's correspondence in his archives where he's swapping messages with guys just really to be kept in touch. This is back in 1904 when it takes place. So he must have surely talked to Elmer, his personal courier, about his experience a year earlier, the train robbery, or the aftermath of the train robbery. So in the book, I speculate that on the first night in camp, when Roosevelt he's had all his photographs taken, you can find bucket loads of photographs in the archives of Roosevelt at the start of that tour. And one of his assistants, Dr. Lambert, took private photographs on the tour of the guys in camp. And there's photographs on the first night of Roosevelt sitting in a canvas tent, his cook's preparing a dinner for him. He's got, you know, the essentials. He's got a Secret Service guy, and he's got staff with him, but mainly local ranchers. So I speculate that it's impossible, surely, that Roosevelt did not ask Chapman what had happened a year earlier. So I use that to kick off the story about how the train robbery occurred. But also, for me, what was just as important, and is probably more important than who's the dead train robber, because the dead train robber is the dead train robber. You know, he screwed up and got killed, end of. What for me was a more poignant story was all the local who got together to form the posse to go after the train robbers, because they're involved from... The reason I call it the day the train robbers came is actually the day the train robbers came to the ranches is on different days. There's a guy who has a hay camp down by the Grand River, and the train robbers arrive there a couple of days before they rob the train, because they're looking for a place to keep their horses, their getaway horses, on the east side of the Colorado River, because they're going to rob the train on the west side of the Colorado River. There's a family called O'Toole, directly opposite Parachute. Now it's now Battlement Mesa, but at the time there were only a handful of farms there. They have a boat. Their boat goes missing. The train robbers stole the boat in the dead of night, rowed it upriver to put it... they pulled in on the riverbank where they were going to stop the train, so they had the means to escape across the river, get to the horses, and so on. There are all sorts of families who live along the route of the escape of the train robbers, who saw the train robbers very briefly, or maybe a bit more than briefly, because as the chase goes on, they're running out of horses, they didn't plan. They have not planned supplies or foods. They're stopping at ranch houses asking for breakfast. So the stories of the people who were there on the day the train robbers came, whatever day that was, are really important. And they're not told. Similarly, the train crew, one of the train crew, whose name will come back to me, who's the express messenger, when you dig into his life, he'd been through two train robberies and at least one major train wreck by the time he retired. So his story, just as a man who lives in the West, is as interesting as the story of the train robbers. So the day the train robbers came isn't actually a story of one day. It's a story of the ordinary folk who you rarely respect, who could have just said, well, it's a train robbery, it's nothing to do with us. Mm-hmm. We'll leave that to the lawmen. But these are the guys who, to use a technical term, got pissed because the train robbers stole some of their horses. The gardeners lost horses to the train robbers. The first that Roller Gardner knew there'd be a train robbery was one of his neighbors turned up banging on his door of his ranch saying, train robbers have just gone by, can we have some horses? And Roller says, yes, of course you can. Oh, his horses have gone, bar one horse. So he's angry because the train robbers have stolen his horses. So although it's called The Day the Train Robbers Came, it's actually a story that covers several different days running up to the train robbery and also days afterwards, because there are guys who were thought might have been involved in the train robbery. There are horse thieves, there are bank robberies, all in the book, of people who were thought to be train robbers. But weren't. So for the Pinkertons, for example, who ultimately decided, well, I'll qualify that. A Pinkerton agent said, this guy who's been shot dead, who'd been buried for a couple of days, then dug up again, this is Harvey Logan, Kid Curry. And everybody says, well, the Pinkertons would say that, wouldn't they? But actually for Lowell Spence, the day the train robber came for him was 2 years earlier. He was in court for several weeks when Harvey Logan, alias Kid Curry, was being tried in Knoxville, Tennessee. And in the end, they couldn't get Logan for train robbery. That was just too hard to place him at the scene. What they could get him for was forging banknotes. They'd found banknotes from the 1899 Wilcox train robbery and the 1900 Tipton train robbery and the 1901 Exeter Switch train robbery on him and his confederates. And it was easier to get them for forging the signatures on the banknotes than it was for the train robberies. So Spence had sat in the courtroom watching this guy for weeks. He was convinced when he saw the photographs of the dead train robber that this was Harvey Logan. He was dispatched to Grand Junction, Colorado, where they'd finally buried the guy. He'd been dead for a couple of days. They dug him up. There's legends that it was weeks before he was dug up. That's not the case. He was dug up within days. And Lowell Spence looked at him and said, yeah, that's Logan. the photographs that have been taken, again, one of the legends is that the photographs were taken after Logan had been dead for several days. The photographs were taken the day after he was killed, so they're pretty well as he looked in life. And those photographs were identified by the jailers, the staff in Knoxville, and various other people. The reason the Pinkertons were averse, as was the Union Pacific. The Union Pacific chief detective is a guy called Bill Canada, who you and I have talked about in the past, was wary. And you can fully understand why. The Pinkertons' business model is based on raising enough concern around banks and railroads that there's an outlaw threat. It's got to be enough concern that they want to buy into the Pinkerton insurance model. But if the Pinkertons are too effective, if they go around killing off every bank and train robber, then the banks and railroads think, well, job done, we don't need to pay the Pinkertons anymore. So it's not in their business interests to declare absolutely and definitively that somebody is a dead train robber, particularly since Logan at the time in 1904, he was the major threat. There were rumors he'd been seen close to the Union Pacific in southern Wyoming, and there was a possibility of an attack on the railroad there. So Lowell Spence, actually, he was quite a brave chap in the sense that on the day he saw the train robber, which was several week or more after the train robbery, he could have just said, well, it might be Logan, it might not be Logan, I'm not so sure, and just towed the corporate line. But he said no. He said straight out, this guy is Harvey Logan, Kid Curry. I've sat in the courtroom with this guy. That's Kid Curry. Now, that could have been career suicide for him, but he stuck to his guns, no pun intended. And so the Pinkertons were ambivalent. It's only years later, by about 1912, they finally conceded that any later sightings of Harvey Logan really didn't pan out. There'd been a bank robbery in Cody in the summer of 1904, and for a while they thought that was Logan. But when the descriptions of those bank robbers were compared with the train robbers, they didn't stack up. There were other guys in the book. I talk about a horse thief called Ben Cruzan, who's on the fringes of the Wild Bunch. Now, he might have been involved because he had a track record of borrowing other people's horses in the Grand Junction parachute area. But unless he'd had major ear surgery between coming out of prison in the early 1900s and the train robbery, he isn't the guy who's the dead train robber. So the story is, as you say, I hope it wasn't too confusing, because it's meant to be a tribute to all the other folk who got involved, from the ranchers who could have just stayed home and said, we're not going after these train robbers, that's the lawman's job, let them do that, but did, to the lawmen who sometimes get a bad rep, compared to the glamorous outlaws. There are several lawmen, Doc Shaws and others, who go out and they go toe-to-toe or bullet-to-bullet with the lawmen up in the high country above the Grand Junction. The telephonist. There's a woman, you don't think of the telephone really playing a key role in train robberies, but I talk in the book about how at the time, and I forget their names, but there were two telephone companies vying for business in that area. And they were putting in telephone lines from Grand Junction through Newcastle, through Rifle, through Silt, all these little towns along the Colorado River, and then up the valleys to the ranchers' places. And there's a lady whose job was to be the telephonist in Silt or Rifle, I could get it wrong. And she coordinated the intelligence coming in. So there are, on one occasion, I think it's the morning of, let me see, the train robbery is the 5th. The morning of the 6th, they stop at the Joe Banta place for breakfast and they steal some horses. And there's a bit of, chest puffing and all this sort of stuff between Joe and the train robbers. And the train robbers obviously win because they're heavily armed and he's a rancher. So off they go. But as soon as they've gone, his wife's on the telephone saying to calling up the authorities on the Grand River in Newcastle, saying the train robbers have just been here. The following morning, the train robbers, who've made a real pig's ear of their escape route, really, they've crossed several divides. They've ridden past the tiny school, painted blue, the Divide Creek School, and they were seen riding past there. They turn up at the Larson Ranch, Mr. Larson's not there. He's away in the fields doing what Mr. Larson does. He's a rancher, he's a farmer, he's providing for his family. Mrs. Larson, her two sons, are there. The train robbers arrive and they try and steal a horse, and the horse kicks off and bucks off one of the train robbers, and the two boys go out with their rifles to take on the train robbers. These are kids. They're 12, 13-year-old kids. You know, they're not supposed to be taking on train robbers. So they're chased off, but they slow the train robbers down enough that the train robbers then begin retreating up Divide Creek. Mrs. Larson promptly gets on the telephone to Rifle and says, the train robbers have been here. By that time, the posse that's got Gardner in it, it's got Joe Dobie, it's got Joe Banter, it's got Elmer Chapman in it, they're close behind the train robbers. And you can stand on the site in the road, still a dirt road, where the ranchers overhaul the train robbers. The train robbers could see them coming, so they hid behind some fallen rock, which is still there to this day. There are pictures of Jim Miller and myself standing where the train robbers stepped out from behind the rock with a sawn-off shotgun. And Kid Curry throws down this sawn-off shotgun and tells the train robbers to go back, otherwise they're going to get hurt. More fool him. And there's a bit of milling around and so forth, and they're only about, I don't know, a couple of hundred yards south of the Larson Ranch, which is still there. And the posse, displaying a degree of sense that the train robbers didn't, says, okay, fine, guys, you know, we'll go back. And they fall back to the Larson Ranch. And the train robbers by this point realize they can't get any further without abandoning their horses. And that's what takes them up the Scree on foot to Gibson's Flats. Meanwhile, Elmer Chapman, who's been working on Divide Creek for says to his fellow ranchers, guys, if we go a little bit further north and cut east following Gibson's Gulch up to the flats, we're going to get ahead of them. And that's what takes us back to where the story began. It's on that morning that the ranchers, who are not paid to chase train robbers, you know, they're raising families and kids. Chapman's got two young kids, or is it Gardner's got two young kids? Anyway, somebody in that posse has got some very young children at the time. You'd think, well, wouldn't he just have stayed at home? But no, they were really peed off at these train robbers, which leads to confrontation. So for those guys, it was as much about telling their stories, because they live on. They, you know, we think of it, again, you and I have talked about this before when I've let you get a word in edgeways, which I won't.
I'm going to stop you here in a minute.
Well, you are or you aren't?
No, I will, but I'm not going to stop you now.
Okay. Well, just to conclude that part of the conversation, we think of the Old West as being old. 1904, that's way, way back in the dawn of time. But the older I get, I realize the shorter time gets, actually. So my grandmother was 12 or whatever it was the day the train robbers came. Some of these guys, we were trying to set up a conversation between the grandkids of Rolly Gardner and myself, which we couldn't do in the end just because of technology. But the Old West isn't that old. They die in the 50s. Rolly Gardner and Elmer Chapman and co. die in the 1950s. You know, they see through the outlaw era, which ends, I'd guess, around the First World War. They see the huge changes, not just in, you know, technology, but in agriculture and everything that the First World War brings. They live through the Second World War. They live through the Korean War. They see the most profound changes this planet has ever seen before they finally die away. So yeah, so it was a real privilege to talk about those guys, the ranchers and the little people who were there the day the train robbers came.
I don't know about you guys, if you're listening, like I could just turn the microphone on and just sit here and just listen to them talk. I don't care what it is. Today we're going to talk about macaroni and cheese. Great. Just talk about it. I don't care what it is. Of course, we're talking to Michael Bell. He's written a book called The Day the Train Robbers Came, the June 1904 Parachute Train Robbery. It's available at Amazon for about $20, about 249 pages, published in 2020 by the English Westerner Society. I urge you to get this book. It's going to be a very fast read. I rarely read a book so quickly, but Markley Gardner has a book out about Billy the Kid that oh my God, it was so good. And then this one came along and I powered through it. It was so good. You were talking about some of the things in the book, the chapters like the railroad and the president and the photographer and all that.
Yeah, yeah.
I was really curious about, well, I'm going to say about the pursuit, your chapter about the pursuit, because you included multiple maps showing arrows that the train robbers traveled. How did you get all of that? Was it based on eyewitness accounts? Did they have multiple interviews with people because they were traveling up and around and down to get away from people? And sometimes it made no sense.
Hello?
Hello? Did I lose you?
I lost you for a second there, Mike.
Oh, did you hear any of that?
Yeah, you were saying about did they have multiple interviews and so on.
Right, about the your chapter, The Pursuit.
Yeah.
How did they come up with all those maps and things? Was it interviews? Was it hand-drawn, you know, maps?
Well, the maps, again, that was one of the things I wanted to just unpack. I wanted it to be almost like, you know, one of those TV programs where, you know, it's 1024, so-and-so does this, and 1035, whatever. Because the story of The Pursuit tends to be truncated. It tends to the train robbery is covered in some detail. You know, there's a whole story there about how they robbed the wrong train because one train switched tracks with another coming through because of the bad weather coming down from Grand Junction. And usually the story then leaps to the fight on the morning of the 9th of June. Train robberies on the night of 7th, 8th June. But when you dig into the newspaper accounts, understandably, everybody wanted to tell their story. So it starts with the Gardeners, whose ranch is on the opposite side of the river from where the train robbery is. Then they head north. The train robbers head north to a place called Adobe Ranch. Then they head across to another creek, to Mam Creek, to the Kissy Ranch. They drop south from there. At one point, it looks like they're trying to head south into Colorado, and then they swing north again. And on Battlement Mesa, at the head of one of the creeks, they run into a posse under Doc Shores. So what I wanted to do was just unpack and lay out in almost, well, actually, in chronological order, what happened, where, when. And if you dig into the newspaper accounts, understandably, everybody wanted to have their, you know, their story told about the day the train robbers came. So there's a wealth of material in various newspapers about what happened on each of those events when the train robbers turned up. Add to that, there's Albert Gardner's manuscripts, because he got his father to tell the whole tale from his point of view before he died. And then it was a relatively simple, this was probably partly prompted by some work I was doing with Bob Bose-Bell, who you and I talked about just before we went on air a while ago. He did a piece in True West magazine for one of his gunfight articles about the parachute train robbery. And the guy who does his maps was trying to work out where all these events took place. I have a whole set of topo maps, very detailed topo maps that I bought years and years ago. So I ended up making maps for Bob and his crew to try and show how the thing unfolded. So you get this interesting zigzag approach that the train robbers cross the river to the Gardner Ranch, steal some horses from there. They go north trying to get back to the river. The speculation is they were trying to get back to a place at which they could cross the river and head north back to Wyoming. But back in 1904, there are far fewer places where you can cross the river. So if you block those places, you force the train robbers either west or east. And in this case, they were going east. And the speculation is that they were coming from Wyoming because earlier in the year, some dubious guys had been seen near the train tracks, the Union Pacific tracks. And it was thought they'd been deterred by the presence of the bandit hunters, the Union Pacific bandit hunters who I've written about in other places. But having come from Wyoming at some point, they were trying to get back there. So what happens is they cross the river, they head north from the Gardner Ranch, heading towards the river. Then they swing east because they can't get any further north. They hit another ranch, steal some more horses, they drop south again, looking as though they're going to head into the sort of hinterlands of Colorado. Then they swing east again, go north. So there's a zigzag track as they try and get back to the river. And on each occasion, they screw it up. Whoever organized the train robbery, if it was Logan or if it was Cruzan, when they were active in the area a decade earlier, the place wasn't anything like as settled as it was come 1904. So they kept running into ranches. Now, they may have thought that was part of the plan. They could steal horses wherever they went, and that would help them make their escape to the east and then into central Colorado, and then either go north or south back to Wyoming if they went north, or back through Colorado, you know, into Oklahoma, into New Mexico and wherever. But on each occasion, they're thwarted simply because there are so many people in the area, living in the area. And they all have telephones. So that every time the train robbers appear, as soon as they've gone, somebody's calling upon the telephone to the exchange in Rifle or Silt to let the authorities know where they're going. And at one point, I think I put it in the book, the train robbers realize that this is to their disadvantage. So they rip out the telephone wire completely. One of the train robbers gets really quite aggressive and rips this telephone off the wall and slams it on the floor and, you know, says that so the woman won't be able to tell where we've gone. And off they ride to the south, at which point her son wires the telephone wire to the wire fence running around their property, which creates a crude connection back to the pole down on the dirt road, and they're able to contact the authorities. Crazy. I forget your question.
We were just talking about the map. We were talking about the maps and how basically you said it was true about the zigzagging, because I looked at the maps and you put arrows. Just so you know, if you've not seen the book, you put arrows showing their travel. And a lot of the travel was like, are they freaking stupid? Like, they were just back and forth. It was a horribly designed plan.
Yeah. They could have crossed the river in a couple of places, but didn't. Mm-hmm. I mean, maybe they thought that the river was guarded. That's why people say it couldn't have been Kid Curry, because Kid Curry, they say, was far too intelligent a train robber. Well, really? I mean, none of the Wild Bunch outlaws displayed a PhD level of intelligence most of the time. Mm-hmm. They commit schoolboy errors in terms of going about crimes and so forth. At one point I thought, well, is there any point writing about who the train robber was? Because what's more important to me was telling the story of those little people whose stories never told. As far as I'm aware, there's only one other book by a guy you should talk to, a chap called Steve Lasseur. He writes about the killing by outlaws of, his great-grandfather, a guy called Lasseur, and a chap called Gibbons. They're two Mormon ranchers who go after the train robber, or go after the outlaws in Arizona in about 1900. And in his book, which is an excellent read, he talks about their families, their lives, their aspirations, the tragedy of finding the bodies of these two guys who've been ambushed. So he really does go into detail about what it means to be on the opposite end of an outlaw activity. These are farm boys or young men who are killed and whose lives and their families' lives are ruined in the aftermath of the Wild Bunch fleeing through Arizona. And that's what I wanted to do here, really, just to dig into the lives of these people whose stories have never been told, but actually they're the heroes of this story. It's not the romantic outlaws who thought, well, we didn't have to work for anything. They thought they were going to hit a payroll train. They thought the train coming through from Grand Junction, ultimately from Denver, was carrying $100,000 in money to pay the army in the Philippines. Well, that's like a couple of million, if not more, today. To get whatever it is. It's a huge amount of money. So their plan was, we'll stop this train, take the $100,000, and that's it. We're out of here, and we'll never have to work again. They come up against farmers who are hard scrabble farmers who are working hand to mouth in land. You go there now, and I should go back to Jim Miller, because Jim Miller took me there three times to the site of the final gun battle. And on the first occasion we went there, we did the thing in reverse. Jim's truck, a parachute, and drove down to a little town called Silt, which is there's almost nothing there, on the Colorado River. And then you drive up Divide Creek. And just before the Larson Ranch, you can drive up, or you used to be able to drive up Gibson's Gulch onto the flats. And we started there and worked our way backwards. So Jim took me back to the Larson Ranch, where the last confrontation was between the ranchers and the outlaws before the final battle. We went to the O'Toole house, where the outlaws stole the boat that they used to row across the river. Having stopped the train, they then rowed across the river to where they'd kept their horses. So we worked our way back down the dirt roads, back to the site of the train robbery. And these days, it's nicely farmed land, well kept. In fact, in the 30 years, I guess, between me first going there and the last time I was there, it's become very gentrified. There was almost nothing on Battlement Mesa the first time we went there. There had been, I forget whether they were coal miners or something, there'd been some sort of settlement there anyway for workers. And now it's a very well-to-do, you know, neatly manicured lawns, neatly manicured drives, neatly manicured people. You know, I guess they have no idea what went on there beforehand. But it looks today little like it did back in 1904, because this is the first generation of settlers that's arrived there. They arrived to find rock, sand, dirt, sagebrush, and they spent their lives turning that into pasture land, into crops, into, you know, herds, whatever. For me, it was important to get into their stories, their lives, their families, as it was to tell the story of the train robbers.
But you did something. You did something where on the first chapter, or not the first chapter, but the third chapter, where you talked about President Roosevelt and Elmer Chapman.
Yeah.
On the last chapter, one of the last, chapter 29, you went back to Elmer Chapman and completed the story. So you started with him talking about the photographer. You spoke the train robbery, and then Elmer telling the story. And then you spent the whole middle of the book telling the story. And then the chapter 29, you came back to Elmer Chapman and finished his story. Like, brilliant.
Yeah.
Really great.
Well, that's what I wanted to. I wanted to live together, because whatever conversation there was between Roosevelt and Chapman and others, it strikes me as significant that in the record, one of the guys who visits Roosevelt, this is a guy called the Reverend Mann, M-A-M-M, after whom one of the creeks that the train robbers traversed is named. And Roosevelt then turns up. He's invited to meet some of the local folk. And he turns up at the Blue School house on Divide Creek. And I forget the date, forgive me. I think it's chapter 28 or 27 or whatever. But again, it's a great little anecdote, because, I mean, these days we're used to seeing presidents. You know, last night I was watching all the stuff about, you know, Biden and Trump and whatever, you know, and the forthcoming election. We're used to seeing all of that on television. Two things are significant about that Roosevelt visit. The first is, Roosevelt could have said, no, I'm on my vacation. I'm not going to turn up here. I'm not going to go to some little hick church in the back country. You know, if there's any votes in this, it's going to be 50. What's that going to mean? But Roosevelt, whatever his flaws as a man and as a president, and we all have those, he decided he would turn up at the little blue church on Divide Creek, the schoolhouse and church on Divide Creek, where a year beforehand the train robbers had ridden by, and he was going to those people. So there are photographs in the book of very informal photographs. Roosevelt, he had no formal gear with him, so the best he could do was take off his chaps and his scruffy bandana and whatever and just brush down his jacket. So he attends the service and he talks to these folks. He didn't have to do that, but he did do it because he thought it was important for him as a president to be seen to be connecting with these people. And in that crowd, although I can't put names to the faces, there are many of the people who were there the day the train robbers came. So these people in that church, in that schoolhouse come church on that divide, had two unique experiences in the space of a year. Some of them went face to face with train robbers, and they didn't have to, but they did. Because they were not happy with train robbers, you know, running rampant over their country. That's one unique experience. The second one is, Roosevelt didn't have to turn up there, but he did. He wanted to go and see these people who were the heart of America, who make America what it is, the farmers who make the food that fuels the engine is America. He turns up there. So for him and for those people, that's a second unique experience. He saw some of the people who fought it out with the train robbers. They saw the president of the United States, something they probably never, ever expected to see in their lifetime. So for that to me, that's as important a unique experience as it was the train robbers. And then I just wanted to close the story because Elmer, I'm cheating now because I've been taking that opportunity to flick through to chapter 29, the days Elmer and Rolla left. And they lived on. You know, they lived on into the 50s, I think it is. Rolla showed the rifle to the school kids in the late 40s, early 50s. He died in 1951, it says here. He died at his home in Grand Valley. Elmer Chapman, obviously Roosevelt died a long time before that. Roosevelt died in his sleep in 1919. So yes, I just thought it was important that we start and end the story with the stories. The train robbers are interesting. Yes, they always will be. I don't know why we romanticize them. They're just outlaws. They're thugs. They're lazy. They don't want to work. Otherwise, they'd have been Elmer Chapman or Rolly Gardner or Joe Doby or whatever. They want to live off the work done by the hardscrabble farmers or factory workers or whatever who make America. They're just too lazy to do that. So I thought it was important to close the story by bringing the lives of Elmer and Rolla and so forth to their conclusions. They die with their families in their beds in the 1950s. And you think, well, by that time, they're watching this stuff on television. They're watching, black and white movies of outlaws and cowboys and Indians, and they lived through it all. Mm-hmm. They were there the day the train robbers came.
Well, and what's surprising is I read your book, and I finished it. I read a lot in bed. That's kind of the end of the day. I just it ends my day really well. Yeah. And I finished the book, and I looked at my wife, and I go, my God, we did Colorado all wrong. I should have read the book first.
Yeah.
Because if you're reading this or you're listening to the podcast, you can see these places because they're along the I-70 between Denver and Grand Junction. And you can stop in Rifle. Now, Rifle's going to be different in Parachute, but right, the town of Rifle and the town of Parachute is still there. You can get off the freeway, stand on a bluff or stand outside and look around. Yeah, there's going to be more houses and it's going to probably be condos and stuff like that, but the mountains and trees will still be there, and you can look upon the same things that these people looked at and go, they're seeing the same thing I saw, or that I'm seeing what they saw. And you can visit it. You can go. There's still actual places. So if you're planning like a trip into a trip into Colorado, and you're thinking about going between Leadville and Grand Junction, like, get the book, because all of this happened in that area. Just amazing. It's just it told my wife. I said, I'm going to have to go back. We're going to have to take a trip along the I-70 again. We're going to have to go back.
Yeah. Well, that's one of the things that's I remember it. This is going back 30 years now, when Jim Miller, bless his soul, sadly Jim died. I lose track of time now. It was either last year or the year before, which is a great loss, because he was his story, he was a cowboy in the 40s when he was a boy. Then he was he was a lineman for, I think, Bell Telephone or AT&T and something for many, many years as well after that when he was older. The very first time I met him, sorry, not the first time, we met at one of these WOLA conferences and we got talking. That he was I'm talking as though he's still here, which to me he still is. He was a gentle giant of a man. He had lots and lots of stories and information. I remember
hold on.
When we did the first
Michael,
trip. Sorry.
Yep. You got about 2 minutes left.
Okay. Right. 30 seconds then. We drove from our tour around the train robbery site, from the gunfight down to the train robbery site. He said, well, come and stay with me and my wife, Norma, and our daughter, Heidi, in Colbran, Colorado. So we drove down dirt roads to get there. And on the way there, he said, well, I used to be the marshal here. Marshal? What? Colbran's a tiny community, but for a while, Jim was the marshal of Colburn, Colorado. And he went through his garage and he was saying, here, do you want this? And he had an archive full of photographs and manuscripts. That's how I got hold of the manuscript written by Albert Gardner. He had a copy of that there. He was such a generous man. He was what the West was all about. He was just generosity and courtesy personified.
Wow. Amazing. Thank you. Okay. I have a minute. Let's say I'll give you two more minutes. Tell me about... No, I will. I had to stop you. Tell us about the art, the photography on the front cover. You got 2 minutes.
Oh, the photography. Well, again, that's from that. When we were talking about the train robbery, I had some photographs even back then because they're in the archives in Denver and various other places of Parachute. And Parachute changed his name. I forget what it changed his name to, but then went back to being Parachute after a while. So I had photographs which are on the cover and in the book of the train station where the train robbers boarded the train. I remember saying to him, but I've got no idea what Roland Gardner looks like, the guy who brought down Kid Curry. And Jim said, oh, I've got a picture of him. It was given to me by his sister, who at the time was still alive in, I forget where, but one of the local towns. So he produced this really faded photograph, which over the years I managed to restore, which is on the front cover of the book. So what you see on the front cover of the book, the guy on the left, which is useless to those who aren't haven't got the book in front of them, but if you buy the book, which I recommend, on the front cover is a picture of Roland Gardner, his wife and his son. Roland Gardner is the guy who saved the life of Elmer Chapman, and Roland Gardner is almost certainly the guy who brought down Kid Curry on that June day in 1904.
Excellent. Well, no end roll, folks. I wanted to take Mike to as much as possible. No advertising. We're not going to do anything at the end because I wanted to hear every minute I could of Mike. Make sure that you get his book. The day the train robbers came, the June 1904 parachute train robbery. It's available at Amazon for about $20. Published by the English Westerner Society. As always, you got anything, Mike? Anything? Just 10 seconds, 20 seconds?
No, just thanks for the opportunity, Mike. And there'll be new material coming out soon on other topics roughly related to the outlaws of that era, and I'll keep you informed.
And will you come back and do more?
Oh, if you insist.
Oh, okay. I insist. All right, everybody. I appreciate you a bunch. Safe travels, and we'll see you soon.